What if she's married? I throw out. What if I'm not attracted to her? How do I know if she's smart? He rolls his eyes. You have so many rules and requirements. No wonder you're hard up. Fuck off, I say, but I'm laughing. For the next hour, he watches the door, muttering assessments like an Olympic judge. That one will be too shrill in bed. That one hasn't read enough Shakespeare for you. Well, that one thinks Rembrandt is only a toothpaste brand. By the time the clock strikes 9:30, I doubt I'll meet anyone interesting enough. But at least I've had a lark with my brother, and I haven't hurt the feelings of any co-worker's friend or cousin or tennis coach. I haven't had to wiggle out of darts, artfully or unartfully, or evade an offer from Freddie's wife. Sure, Judy's kind of doing what I loathe, setting me up, but I'm not his project. He doesn't feel sorry for me. And there's no workplace fallout if I don't like the woman he picks for me. Jude will go on his way, and we'll have a drink again next Sunday, and the next until he returns to New York, when his limited run play ends in a few more weeks. Well, never a dull moment with you, I tell him. That too is always the same. He doffs an imaginary hat. Ditto, Heath. Thanks for giving me inspiration for when I need to play a grump. I roll my eyes. Yes, that's what I'm here for. And I suppose I should be on my way, I say, about to push back from the stool. Then she walks in. The brunette is dressed in a pale yellow blouse, unbuttoned to reveal just a hint of flesh. Her lips are full, pouty. Her hips are made for holding. And yet, even from a distance, it's her soulful blue eyes that capture me. They're full of stories, longing, like she's missing something too. Maybe not even a someone, but the idea of a someone. Perhaps it's just my imagination, but I'll run with it, especially as she scans the establishment, then locks eyes on me. Jude whistles low in my ear. Target acquired, and your wingman exits stage left. In a heartbeat, he's gone. The dark-haired beauty heads straight for the counter, sets down a red paperback next to me. She parts her lips, the briefest hesitation matching the flicker of nerves in her blue eyes. Hey there, she says. Her American accent is terrifically fetching. Hi to you, I say. I have my own case of nerves as I cycle through conversation to make. Banter, wit, charm. Those brain cells haven't died from disuse, have they? She drums her fingernails on the bar. So, she lets out a long breath, nibbles on the corner of her lips, then blurts.
I don't have a library card, but do you mind if I check you out?
There's a silent, awkward beat. And then she breaks into laughter, launches into peals and peals of it. I laugh too, because the sound of hers is so infectious, and now here we are, both cracking up. This is not what I expected tonight, but here it is for the taking. And I take. As the laughter fades, I pivot, flipping the dreadful line back on her. I don't mind at all, but I should warn you, you'll have to check me out overnight. We both laugh again. She holds up a hand as she attempts to rein in her humor.
Confession. I googled pickup lines and I can't think how you could say any of them without sounding absolutely ridiculous.
I rather liked it. But then I like libraries. I appreciate research too, so that's doubly impressive.
It's true. I have no idea how people meet in bars or what they say. So I asked the internet. I have more where those came from.
I don't even have to fake being a sunshiny guy. I can be that man in this moment. Are you looking to test them on someone? She smiles, and it's such a sweet, pretty grin that my chest warms.
Are you interested in being a test subject?
As a matter of fact, I am.
Chapter 4. Joe. This is both harder and easier than I'd thought. This is nothing like swiping left or right on an app. Nothing like matching up with someone online. This is so old-fashioned that it's odd. But it's kind of working, especially since this guy has that young Harrison Ford vibe about him, circa Raiders of the Lost Ark, but with a London accent. Translation? Scorching. I straighten my shoulders, preening a bit as I try out another pickup line. Well, I'm here. What are your two other wishes? The handsome man grins, all crooked and just shy of cocky. He rubs his thumb lazily along the edge of his glass.
At the moment, I can only wish for better music and to get you a drink.
Oh, he is good. The bar's speakers are piping something soft and jazzy. What type of music? I ask.
I'm omnivorous, but jazz bores me. I'd wish for Bolero by Ravel, or anything by Queen or Roxy Music.
I offer a hand to high-five. He gives it a curious look. Fine, maybe high-fives aren't an English thing, but goes with it, and we smack palms. That was for the dislike of jazz, I explain. I'm with you there, but otherwise, I'm Rodgers and Hammerstein all the way. The bartender swings by and asks if I'd like a drink. I choose a lemon drop, then return to my target. This must be what fishing is like. I've never gone fishing, so I'm guessing, but holy hell, I feel like I just got a bite. A big bite from a handsome fish. Wait, I can't think of this man as a fish, but he is a catch.
Okay, so I've got my second wish,
he says.
Getting you a drink. My music dreams will remain unfulfilled, but feel free to enchant me with more pickup lines.
I gear up for the next one, adopting my best sex-drenched voice. Baby, if you were words on a page, you'd be fine print. He chuckles into his hand.
Stop. Just stop.
This is going better than I thought. Tilting my head, I turn a little coy, playful. So I should tell Google that one's a no?
Yes, do let Google know, he says.
The bartender swings by with my lemon drop. Here you go, she says. I reach for my purse, but the British Indiana Jones sets a hand next to mine and asks, maybe a touch tentative,
may I?
The question sends a cascade of tingles down my spine. That he asked, but also how he asked. You may, I say softly, sounding more demure than I intended. I'm not a demure person, but something about his offer brings that out in me. He places a bill on the counter, then lifts his glass and offers it in a toast.
To chance encounters. I'm Heath.
That name. It's so Emily Bronte and windswept moors. That's very literary, Heathcliff, I say, clinking back. And I'm Joe.
You're one to talk about literary names, Joe, he says, then whispers, March, as in Little Women.
I try not to smile too wide. That's exactly the fictional Joe I'd want to be. He takes a drink, then sets down his glass.
So, these pickup lines, do you like them? Would they work on you?
They're silly. I shrug lightly. There's a time and a place for silly, but they aren't my speed.
And what is?
His question that made me shiver. That's my speed. If a man says, may I, when he asks to pay for your drink. Heath dips his handsome face with a gentle laugh and a smile that reads more genuinely than the cocky Harrison Ford grin from before. It's a good look on him. But then a lot of things look good on him. His face, for instance. He is ridiculously handsome in a way that should be illegal. It's not fair that anybody could be this handsome, with his close-cropped brown hair, his striking, slightly stubbled jawline, and yep, he has a tiny scar on his chin. Indiana Jones, indeed. A few crinkles touch the corners of his eyes. They are what engage me most. They're rich with stories, with tales of loves lost and won, secrets uncovered, passions shared. This is a man who's lived. I bet he doesn't have Snapchat either. Heath clears his throat.
Now, I have to ask, since you researched pickup lines, does that mean you came in here in hopes of picking someone up? Also, is that what they even call it anymore? I have to be honest, I'm a little rusty.
That's so damn endearing, honesty and all. I'm kind of rusty, too. I'm new to town, and, confession, my friends from New York challenged me to go out and meet someone tonight. His lips twitch.
Wouldn't you know? My brother from here challenged me to do the same.
Maybe it's kismet, I say with a laugh.
Do you believe in kismet?
He asks, seeming more curious than judgmental.
In fate?
I'd like to. I sip my drink and set it down. But right now, I'd like to believe that my terrible pickup lines might actually be working. I watch his reaction, feeling bold, feeling daring, feeling like maybe he was everything my friends had in mind for me. Heath leans a little closer, lowers his voice.
Your pickup lines are definitely working.
A pause follows, a little awkward, maybe because neither one of us knows exactly how serious we are about our plans for the night. In that space, I calculate. Am I really doing this? Is he asking himself the same? He draws a breath like it fuels him.
So, what brings you to town?
Then he holds up a hand and shakes his head.
That was actually a terrible line in general, so let's pretend I didn't ask.
I touch my fingers to my temples, shut my eyes, then open them again. Erased.
I'll start over.
He gestures to my Hazel Valentine book.
Speaking of libraries and things to check out, are you enjoying your book?
My face heats slightly, and I hesitate. When you tell a person what you read, sometimes their reaction reveals who they are. Some judge, and some don't. I prefer the latter. It's a love story, I say, lifting my chin. His expression goes serious.
Is it an escape?
You're not going to tease me about reading romance novels? I ask. His brow knits in confusion.
Is that a thing people do?
So much. Too often. I've been ridiculed for my taste in books, my love of musicals, my affection for pop songs. Some people think you should only read serious literature or important nonfiction. Heath's expression is comically astonished.
People mock reading, make fun of books. Well, besides silly quote books culled from social media feeds.
Social media is fair game for mockery. And yes, some people mock reading and certain types of stories, I say with a laugh.
People,
he mutters, like he disapproves of them in general. I like people generally. But now that I've said it, that does sound unbelievably petty of them. He taps the back cover of my book gently.
How does the book make you feel?
The question makes me dig into my emotions about the story, examine them, and I like that. I flip to the back cover, featuring a couple kissing on the streets of New York, and my heart glows a little. Possible, I say. It makes me feel possible. He hums softly, perhaps in understanding.
That's a good feeling,
he says a little heavily, and that weight in his voice makes me want to ask more questions. But that's not what tonight is. It's not a date. It's not dinner and a getting to know you. This is a one-night stand with a hot British man. Or so I hope. Be bold. Have some bloody fucking fun in London. I shove past the nerves, the fear of rejection, the what-ifs, and I go for it. Would you like to kiss me? As soon as the words escape, my hand flies to my mouth. I can't actually believe I just said that. Heath tilts his head, studying me.
Do you want to take it back?
His voice is a low rumble, sliding over my skin. The air between us crackles, charged and sparking. No, I whisper.
Then do you want me to answer, Joe?
Very much so. He doesn't reply with words, but with deeds. He lifts one hand, cups my jaw, slides a thumb along it. It's been a long time since I've had a memorable kiss, one to crave later. The kind of kiss you imagine when you dream of kissing. He lowers his head, inches away, then breathes out my name, all sultry and a little bit dirty in that growly, rich voice of his.
Joe,
he whispers, somehow stretching out two letters seductively, like he's testing the flavor, letting it roll across his tongue. It hardly feels like we're in a bar in the middle of the city, with other patrons drinking pints or ale or shots or cocktails all around us. I don't care about that while I'm caught in this promise of a kiss, in the giddy haze of anticipation. He lets it build, his gaze lingering on my lips. Then he dusts his mouth softly across mine, a soft, tender brush of a kiss. This stranger kisses me in a bar, that most old-fashioned of meeting places. Kisses me like he's savoring every second of this moment, like kissing is a treasure. As his lips sweep over mine, I'm completely convinced that it is. It is a rare and precious thing to be kissed like you matter. I can barely breathe for how good it feels. My toes tingle. Sometime later, it could be seconds, it could be another lifetime, we break the kiss. I feel woozy and tipsy. He looks the same, wearing the barest hint of a smile.
Do you want to get out of here?
Is that a pickup line? I ask, breathless. There's that cocky grin again, that action hero charm.
It absolutely is.
It's working. 20 minutes later, he holds open the door of my hotel, makes a quick stop at the concierge desk, and then heads with me to the elevator. The second the doors close, nerves wind tight inside of me. The laughter and lightness from the bar disappear, and he's all intensity. His eyes turn darker, almost brooding, and he stares, undressing me with his gaze. The elevator climbs. Closing the distance in a heartbeat, Heath cups my face and kisses the hell out of me. It's a completely different kiss from the first one. This is deep and needy, a desperate kind of kiss, almost like he's afraid I'll vanish if he doesn't devour me. Heat rushes through me in delicious tingles that light up my skin, that flip my insides, that make me feel buzzed in all the best ways. Devoured, too. Consumed with the need that seems to radiate from him. The elevator slows at my floor. Dings. We stumble out. My instinct is to talk, to fill the silence with words. But I don't know that anything needs to be said, and I don't feel like throwing out a sassy comment or a note of banter. I'm an ocean away from my home and my friends and my life. All I want tonight is the purity of the physical connection, of intimacy with a stranger. When we reach my room, I slide the card key against the door and we tumble inside. In a second, he pushes me up against the wall and his kisses continue. He journeys everywhere. His lips travel all along my neck, across my shoulder, nipping my collarbone, licking the hollow of my throat. He kisses me like he's mapping my skin with his lips and mouth and tongue. My knees turn to jelly. I'm hot and achy everywhere, wanted in a way I've never felt before. Maybe we can even do this again. Not so fast. This is just a one-night stand. Don't let your thoughts gallop away. I focus on the here and now and linger in how good he is with his mouth as I take all of his kisses. My thoughts turn hazier. They wander away, leaving the room, frolicking around London. This city's not so bad, really. Not if kisses like this exist in this place. Have I just been kissing the wrong men all along? Maybe I've been missing out. Maybe I've seen the wrong men. Because apparently, there's a whole other kind of kiss out there. A kiss you can drown in. A kiss that's soft and tender, but passionate and deep. It's a fierce, hazy vibration, like all my senses have been tuned and sharpened. Like I'm a violin, and the man playing me isn't even a master. He's just obsessed with the strings. That's how it feels. This kiss feels a little like a dreamy obsession. I sink into it, falling deeper and deeper into the sighs and murmurs, into the groans and gasps, into the hands that clasp my cheeks, roughly at first, but then travel, sliding down my arms, along my sides, around my back. I don't even know where to focus. Pleasure pings me everywhere, zipping to my toes and fingertips. But most of all, it's right here inside me, pulsing between my legs. I don't want to wait a single second longer. I somehow find the will to break the kiss and run my thumb along his swollen lips, meet his dazed eyes. In them, I see a wild need I've never witnessed before. Take me. Take me now. He sweeps me up in his arms, crosses to the king-size bed, and strips me. Then his clothes vanish too. Welcome to London, Joe.
Chapter 5. Heath. Two voices echo in my head. One needles me, taunting. It's been a while. Do you even remember how this works? Surely there are new techniques that have emerged over the years. New tricks, new skills. You don't know any of them. The other one simply whispers, touch her, kiss her, please her. As I make my way up her naked flesh, brushing open-mouthed kisses along her thighs, the dip of her stomach, the curves of her hips. Bless them indeed, that voice quiets the other. Some things haven't changed at all. Desire. I kiss her skin, her breasts, her shoulders, and the delicious hollow of her throat with fervor that borders on worship. Her moans tell me that's exactly how she likes to be touched, like she's adored. She arches and writhes, her hands flying to her hair, her own fingers threading through her lush locks, like somehow that's the only way she can handle this lust. I'm not sure I can handle this lust. I'm not sure what to do with this overabundance of it, a supply that can barely even seem to fit in this room, let alone this building. But I'm willing to try. Oh, yes, I am. I pour all my longing into the way my hands roam along her body. She loops a hand into my hair, then slides the other down my chest, pressing it firmly against my pecs.
Hold on, we need a condom,
she breathes. Right, right, I say, nodding then jump off the bed. I root around for my trousers. I grabbed one from the concierge when we walked into the hotel. But when I turn around, she's brandishing one.
I'm prepared too.
Maybe she grabbed it from her purse, or had it on the nightstand. Or who fucking cares? That's just smart. Lady's choice then, I say.
Yours now, mine next time, she says.
I like her philosophy, and I'm back on the bed in the span of one breath, rolling it on, then kneeling between her legs. She parts her thighs, and a rumble works its way up my chest, skips my lips. Have I ever sounded this carnal before? This greedy? Hell if I know. She's so beautiful, ready and aroused. I could spend hours worshipping your body, kissing you, tasting you, I tell her. She nods, then makes a rolling gesture with her hands.
I have no doubt I'll come 50 times, but right now, I really want you inside me.
Ask, and it shall be given to you, I say. Then I sink in. Her body grips me, so hot and tight and so wickedly wet, that the thought occurs to me, I won't last long. And yet there is no way on heaven and earth that I'm going to come before her. I grit my teeth, lower my chest, and swivel my hips, concentrating on her. Joe's hands curl around my head, her fingers playing with the ends of my hair.
Oh, that's so good,
she whispers on a heady moan. Those words make my skin sizzle. My pulse surges. Her back arches as she moves with me, her eyes fluttering open and closed. She grabs the back of my head as I thrust, going deeper. Electricity crackles down my spine, radiates across my entire body.
Yes, I like it deep. Love that, she says,
I follow her every order, only too happy to obey her directions. What else do you like? I rasp out. Your arms around me, the way you stare at me, your voice, she says. Then on a long, deep thrust, she groans wantonly. They say that sex is like riding a bike, that you just hop back on and you never forget. Whoever came up with that saying is stupid. This is nothing like riding a bike. This is like living inside Ravel's Bolero. The pleasure intensifies with every note, with every measure in the rising crescendo. Her hands clutch at my back, her nails scratch at my flesh, grabbing and digging. Vaguely, I consider that she'll leave marks. That feels right too, and fitting. Scratch me, bite me, mark me, I want to say. I want to remember how good this feels, how good it feels to be part of an orchestra. Her moans intensify. They trip the switch in me, and that crescendo becomes relentless. The swirl and twist of pleasure, the tight, tense coil. The swell of the music, the finale drawing near. The exquisite agony of feeling this good, so good, too good. Her words. She cries out, bowing her back, her sounds echoing in my mind and reverberating in my bones. She crests, then falls blissfully on the other side of desire. Like that, I still, tense, then let go as pleasure takes over entirely, blurring the world. For long seconds that seem to spill into minutes, I am someplace else. Someplace wonderful I don't want to leave. But soon, I come down from the high, ease out of her, then deal with the matter at hand, cleaning up. Quickly, I dispose of the condom, then return to her, and kiss her neck and her shoulder. She laughs softly, then turns her face to me. She looks radiant.
That was...
It's not really like riding a bike, is it?
If so, that's the best bike ride I've ever had, she says.
Then she yawns, deep and hearty, like it comes from inside her soul. You should go to sleep, Joe, I tell her, gently stroking her cheek. She yawns again.
I really should. Big day tomorrow, she says, stretching her arms.
Big day doing what? Are you visiting the Tower of London? Big Ben? The Tate? I want to tell her my favorites, to weigh in on her agenda. The Tate is too huge, too teeming with crowds, too terribly unpleasant, but you should go anyway, because the collections are worth it. Or if you want a list of bookshops in the city, I've got that right here in my head. I could even take you after work. That is, if you're not too busy with whatever you're here for. Holiday, friends, family, work. A quick glance around tells me little. It's dark and there are only one or two suitcases here, but they are large. Maybe she's here for more than a few days. I'm dying to learn more about her. But is that what this is? Are we supposed to talk now? No idea. Still, a gentleman shouldn't fuck and run. And I don't want to. So I give in to what I want and ask a simple question. How long are you in town?
A while,
she says, sounding terribly sleepy, drifting off already. That's good. I swallow roughly, hunting for more words, hoping to unearth some captivating one somewhere. Maybe I left them back at Sticks and Stones, or in Nigel's shop. Hell if I know. I can't seem to find them now that they're important.
Maybe,
she murmurs. Is this her way of saying, thanks for the orgasm, you can see yourself out? Maybe she didn't mean it when she said, next time. Ah, perhaps this is why dating failed me, because I failed at dating. I'll let myself out, I say, wanting to say more, hoping she'll tell me not to rush. She seems utterly content, though, to slide into slumber. This is just a one-night stand. Of course it is, you daft idiot. That's what it was always supposed to be. Joe turns to me, all sleepy soft. She lifts an arm,
slides her hand down mine. But you can take my number if you want. Heath. The way she says my name is like a goodnight kiss, sweet and tender. A promise of another kiss, another time. All my anxiety slinks away. I sigh in relief, grateful she put me out of my misery. Before she falls asleep, we exchange numbers. Then I gather my clothes, get dressed, and kiss her once more. She's already asleep, a strand of her brown hair fluttering softly across her face. I move it from her cheek. When I make my way out, my eyes drift to her suitcase on the floor, then to a large purse by the entryway table, perhaps a satchel, stuffed with books and two framed photos. I can't make out what they're of, and I'm not a peeping Tom. Still, she's a woman after my own heart.
Chapter 6. Joe. Avoiding Chelsea is easy since, well, this hotel is in St. James, a few blocks from my new office. I wake up bright and early on Monday, ready to make the most of the day before I start in the London office tomorrow. When I move, I feel the blissful soreness that comes from good sex. Or was that great sex? My body answers with a whoosh and a whoa, and a brand new ache between my legs as the memories race through my body, the way he touched me, kissed me, fucked me. Okay then, that was great sex. I get out of bed and ride the high that morning. I suppose there's just something about an orgasm that makes everything better. I spend the morning prepping for my first day at work. In the afternoon, I check my route on my phone to the flats the leasing agent sent me in Charing Cross. I contacted him before I left New York since I don't want to stay in the hotel too long. Then I meet David near Trafalgar Square, and he shows me a couple nearby places. "This one is fantastic," I say, as soon as he swings open the door to the third one. I ooh and ah over the space. The bathroom is a tiny bit bigger than my one in New York. And there's more light, a few more windows with sun streaming in. Plants line the windowsill, making the place cheerier than I expected. "I might already be in love," I add.
"Glad you like it," the jolly man says with a chuckle.
I peer out windows that overlook a bustling street, red double-decker buses and black cabs whipping by. "I can't complain about a thing. It has a room with a view," I quip. When his face goes blank, I just shake my head and add, "I'll take it." I bet Heath would get the remark. I bet he'd be amused by the E.M. Forster reference. Is Heath a librarian? A novelist? A literary agent? Or just a learned man? A dark thought flashes through my brain. What if he's a professor? Like my father? I hope not. I'd hate for them to have anything in common. But a librarian would be hot. I can picture Heath in some quiet institution, enrobed in silence all day, checking out tomes. Betty wears reading glasses and looks all studiously studly in them. Maybe I should text him today. Is that too soon, though? I have no idea what the rules are. I haven't met anyone in person in ages. I met the last few guys I dated online, and they were entirely focused on themselves and didn't even realize it. One wanted to talk about how stressed he was, the other about his self-care routines, and yet another about his goals. But then, I've never had any luck in the romance department, so it should be no surprise they were busts.
"We can do the paperwork now," the leasing agent says.
As I sit at the flat's tiny kitchen table, I try to stay focused on the practical details of being in this new city, signing a lease, rather than on the romantic ones of my one-night stand. The first one I've had in ages. Or is that ever? I cycle back through the last decade, stopping at Jacob in grad school. My romantic encounters film reel is short. It probably wouldn't qualify for the shorts category at the Oscars. It's more the length of a commercial. Oh well, I have work and friends. Someday, maybe I'll find more. When we're finished with the paperwork, the agent tells me I can take occupancy tomorrow. Before I go, I drink in the flat one more time. The couch is comfy, and there's a spot on the coffee table for my two favorite framed photos. I pat the side of my purse where I keep them. One is of Mom and me when I was in high school. She's smiling brightly, letting me fasten a simple locket around her neck. She called me her stylist, and I cherished the term because it came from her. The other pic is of my New York family and me, taste-testing veggie burgers in Brooklyn. TJ, Easton, and I were giving Nolan and Emerson a hard time over their food rating system, as friends do. It'll be perfect right there, next to the shot of Mom. The two pictures remind me of the good things in life and the people I can depend on. That's why I carry them with me. I thank the agent, and we part ways on the street. I take the scenic route as I wander back to the hotel, the city unfolding as I go. I swear I try to see London for what it is, rather than for what I felt a decade ago. Shoving those memories away as best I can, I remember that this city is home to museums and galleries, monuments and theaters, libraries and universities, and also to everyday stores. Like on this block, as I turn down a quieter side street along the river and pass a pub sporting a brick facade and a hanging sign that says Goat's Head Tavern. Very English indeed. A little farther, and I meander by a wine store, then a tiny pop-up shop peddling stamps at the end of the block, inked stamps with cutouts of dolphins, bicycles built for two, chipmunks, stars, and everything else under the sun on them. There. I survived my first walk in this city. Here on this block, there's nothing I need armor for. London is just like any place else. It's a skein of locations, addresses, people. People like Heath, whoever he is. And yes, people like Poppy, wherever she is. Poppy is merely one of several million people in this city. I haven't seen my one-time best friend since the summer I studied in London for my master's program, visiting her after my mother died, needing her shoulder to lean on as I grieved the loss of the woman I'd admired, the woman I'd wanted to be like, a woman who loved big and hard with all her heart until her dying day. Poppy had been there for me in college when Mom got sick, when she went through chemo and then lost her battle to cancer after only 1 year. Poppy was the sister I'd never had, a rock to lean on. She was my person for a while, and I was hers. I'd needed her especially because Jacob, the guy I'd fallen for in grad school, broke up with me while we were studying together in London. One afternoon, while strolling through Hyde Park, I pointed out a flower that reminded me of my mom. He sighed heavily, held out his hands, and announced that he couldn't do this anymore. "Do what?" I'd asked, utterly thrown. "I can't handle your grief." I'd sputtered in shock, but he had it all together. He said he preferred me happy and asked when I was going to move on. It had been a year since she died, after all, he'd said. Wasn't it time I got over being sad about it and bringing him down too? "No," I'd told him sharply by a colorful flower bed. "There was no statute of limitations on grief." "Then this is goodbye," he'd said. And then he left. Left me crying by the tulips. When I told Poppy that night over a bottle of wine at a tavern, she was livid. She'd remained that way for weeks, outraged, concerned for me and my feelings. But not so concerned, after all, it turned out. Now, as I walk along the river, I flash back to a week ago in my apartment in New York, to Emerson and TJ asking what I'd do if I saw her. Mostly, I hope to avoid her, since I don't know how I'd handle it if we met. But maybe I can simply avoid Chelsea, her stomping ground. She owns a gallery there, runs it with him. London belongs to her, not to me. I don't hurt like that anymore, but I'd rather not run into her either. And that ought to be easy enough. I have a new flat, a terrific shot at becoming a VP at my company, and maybe I can see my Englishman again. I stop at the bank of the river, gazing at the water that winds through the city. What side of the Thames does the man I met last night live on? What is he doing right now? Is he daydreaming of last night, too? Maybe I can see him again. Have a little London fling, something to make me miss New York less. With this delicious, sex-sated feeling of possibility running through my veins, London doesn't seem quite so bad. And the present is pretty good. So good, in fact, that I'm not going to lose sight of the friendships that matter most to me. For starters, I give TJ and Emerson what they asked for. I lean against the stone railing, arrange myself in a jaunty pose, and snap a selfie to send to my crew. Then I click on the video and talk to the camera as I walk. "Hey guys, just wanted you to know you always give the best advice, and naturally I took it. Do I look like I met a sexy stranger last night?" I slow my pace, angling my phone towards the river and all her bridges, since my friends will want to see them. "Because I sure did. Met him, romanced him, and then took him to..." I hear myself and wince, then stop recording. I sound so jokey, so what up, girl? And I hate it. Nothing about last night felt silly. Nothing felt disposable. Last night felt like it was supposed to happen. A surreal sensation runs through my body, the sense I'm being a little ridiculous, but also respectful. I'm not sure how the two things coexist, but they do. I delete the recording. I can't make a gossipy video about last night, even to send to two of my closest friends. Instead, I call Emerson. The phone barely rings before she answers. "Are you dead? Because that's the only reason anyone calls anymore." I laugh. "Yes, I'm calling you from my grave. Just wanted to give you the funeral deeds and request that you say something nice about me." "I'll tell the story of how we met," she says. "Aw, I love that story. It's so modern," I say as I walk through the English afternoon. "I was looking for a place to talk about Fun Home with other musical geeks. And I was dying to find a theater buddy in New York City, back when I was in San Francisco. Someone to join me for afternoons of Hamilton and Dear Evan Hansen," she says. "And we found each other in an online group," I say, smiling. "And people wonder why we're dorks who love musicals. I don't know if anyone actually wonders that," I say. "Anyway, how is everything going? Do you hate it more, a little more, a lot more?" "Actually, I don't hate one thing," I say enticingly. She shrieks. "You did it? You actually did it? You met an English hottie and got some action?" Yes, this is technically gossiping, but it hardly feels like it. Talking one-on-one rather than faux bragging isn't gossiping. Is it crazy that it was kind of... what's the word? Amazing sticks to my brain, reverberates in it. But that's so overused. When a latte can be amazing, I'm not sure I want to put sex in the same category. "Hold on a sec," I say as I reach a corner and get my bearings, then duck onto a cobblestone side street where it's quieter. "So this guy, last night, it was different." There's a pause on the other end, a crackle across the phone line. Maybe it's a testament to the tone in my voice that Emerson doesn't crack a joke like, "different in that he wanted to lick your toes, or braid your hair, or have you call him daddy?" When she speaks, her question comes out with a certain gravitas. "Are you going to see him again?" I feel that gravitas too. I stop my pacing, set a hand on my chest, try to quell these weird nerves inside me. "I think..." "Are you asking me?" Emerson asks, and now there's a smile in her voice. "Or yourself?" That's a good question, but it has an easy answer. "I'm going to call him tonight." That feels like the perfect way to end the evening before I start work tomorrow. I return to my hotel room, settle onto my king-size bed, letting the memories of several hours ago zip down my body. With a satisfied sigh, I find Heath's name in the contacts. But before I can call him, my phone rings. It's my father.
Chapter 7. Heath. I can't believe I'm doing this. This is not me. And yet here I am, waiting at the stage door with the other groupies. Grand. Just grand. But truly, groupies are fantastic. My brother worked hard enough for the last decade, chasing role after role, cutting his teeth, learning his craft. Jude deserves fans queued up to have him autograph their programs. When I took our parents here for opening night a few weeks ago, the three of us were the loudest in the audience, and wildly proud. "Thanks for coming, Maggie," he says to a tall woman with a sharp nose and kind eyes. "So glad you loved If Found, Please Return. Hope you enjoy And So It Begins as well."
"I've no doubt I will. You're incredible," she says,
then slides in close and snaps a picture of the two of them. A few more flourishes of the Sharpie, a few more photos, then Jude ushers me past the heavy black door to the backstage area. "Is it like that most nights? They wait for you before a show." He gives an easy shrug. "Yeah, and after." "Amazing," I say. As we wind through the narrow hallways of the theater, I try to sort through the mess in my head that brought me here. The way my mind tossed and turned all day at work, and to how Google, in incognito mode, obviously, gave me no help in understanding dating protocol. Along the way, Jude says hello to the stagehands, the makeup artists, and the other actors. We reach his dressing room and head inside, where he inhales deeply, then says, "And now, entertain me." Jude flicks on the LED lights around the mirror and slides into the chair, swiveling it to face me. I exhale as I take a seat on the couch, but that doesn't loosen the knot of uncertainty inside me. "All I want to know is what to do next," I say. "Couldn't you have just texted me the answer when I texted you, and maybe dispensed with all this theatricality, rather than insisting I show up here?" He scoffs. "No, no. Also, no. Plus, you're literally a stone's throw away, and I'm going back to New York soon, so we'll take what we can get." He has me there. Best to enjoy these moments. "True. Good to see you. Also, it's too complicated with you and women and dating. I can't just text you how to do it because, well, you're you." "And that means what?" "Need I refer to Exhibit A? You, last night in the bar admitting you have no game." "Thanks for the reminder." He grins and slugs my arm. "But apparently you do. You have so much game. I'm fucking proud of you." He shoots me a salacious grin. "Did it make your toast better? Like I predicted?" I stare him down. He's asking for it. "Best toast I've ever had." "Told you so." "Thanks. Now, tell me what to do." "Because you want great toast again? With jam on it," he teases. "I want the toast, the jam, and the company. So, how in the bloody hell does this work?" "Well, last time I dated a woman was..." Jude stares at the ceiling of his dressing room. Let's see. Never." "Piss off. People are the same." He shrugs. "Sort of." "Well, you've pretended to date women on stage and film," I say with an impish grin. He winks at me. "Many. So many, and I make all genders swoon." "Yes, you do. So, since you have a curtain in the near future, maybe you could get on with dispensing the Jude Fox wisdom," I say, using his stage name. His blue eyes shift from playful to serious. "You want to see her again. She made an impression on you, and you kind of hate all things modern dating. So, what would I do? Well, in the past, I'd have DM'd someone on Insta." I shudder, horror movie style. "That sounds ghastly." A small laugh falls from his lips as he heads to the costume rail, tucks clothes off hangers. See? That's my point. You hate that stuff. You dated in the Stone Age. The way I see it is you can either learn all sorts of modern lingo, or you can just be you. Which means... Asking for dating advice, even from my brother, is more uncomfortable than I'd anticipated, and I'd expected to feel 20,000 leagues under a sea of discomfort. Jude makes a phone of his fingers, raises it to his ear, and speaks into his pinky. Hi there, hot American babe. This is your strapping English stud from last night. Want to... I hold up a hand, cutting him off. Got it. Jude drops his pretend phone. It's adorable that you know nothing about modern dating. But it's okay. Just lean into it, Heath. Lean into it, I repeat. That makes sense. It's all I can do. I gesture to the poster with his face on it next to the door. Break a leg. I'll break two, he says. I repeat that new mantra the whole way home, then one more time. Lean into it, before I pick up the phone.
Chapter 8. Joe. I brace myself for my father's advice. Because he's not calling to make small talk, he never does.
Are you ready for tomorrow, Josephine?
He asks, sounding exactly like the brilliant but distant professor that he is. Of course, I say, spine straight, shoulders back.
It's a big change.
Yes and no. I stand, moving off the bed. I don't want to talk to him in the same space where I was last night. He hums, a sound laced with doubt.
Seems foolish to try to spin it both ways, Josephine.
Life isn't always black and white, Arthur, I say. He chuckles, which translates to, are you still doing that? Calling me by my name.
In any case, I just wanted to wish you good luck tomorrow. London is a cutthroat world for art.
I sneer. This is a good luck call? Could have fooled me. Thanks for the well wishes, I say, trying to strip the sarcasm out of my tone.
I hope you're not in over your head at Highsmith. I suspect you'll have to work 10,000 times harder than you think.
Thanks again. I glance around the room, searching for a reason to end the call, and spot my suitcase. I need to go prep for tomorrow. I hang up after the barest of goodbyes, then grit my teeth and close my eyes. I take a breath. I exhale. And I try to let go of him and his doubt. For my first day, I want to wow this Emily Hathaway. Show her what I'm made of, that I do work 10,000 times harder than anyone, and that I deserve a promotion to VP. I choose an outfit for tomorrow, lay it out on the desk chair, then answer my work emails. Maybe later I'll be in the mood to try that phone call again. But I'm not now. I'm closing my suitcase when the phone rings a second time. With an annoyed sigh, I grab it, about to say, "What now, Arthur?" But the name Heath flashes across my screen. All my senses light up. They bounce around in my body. Am I really this woman, the one so delighted by a man calling? I haven't even answered, and yet bubbles float inside me. I slide open the phone, my lips parting softly, wanting to say just the right words. Instead, a simple hi comes out.
Hello.
And the bubbles rise higher. Hi, I say, then realize I'm repeating myself, but he doesn't seem to care.
I want you to know I tried, valiantly, I assure you, to find suitable literary pickup lines, he says.
I smile, too broad for my face, and flop onto the bed, settling into the pillows. And you didn't find any?
Oh, I found far too many.
Are you going to keep them all to yourself?
I'm not sure I can bring myself to share them, Joe.
So you called to tell me you have a collection of cheesy pickup lines and you're just going to taunt me with them? Keep them all to yourself?
I'm terrible, obviously,
he says, deadpan and so very British. Just awful. But fair is fair. I gave you some top-tier cornball come-onlines last night. Serve up yours. Come on. I'm waiting. With an exaggerated sigh, he says,
This pains me. Truly it does.
I shift to my side. A bed has never felt more comfortable, a little moment never more delightful. You can do it. I have faith.
Fine. I'll try.
He clears his throat, then his voice goes all deep and almost dirty.
Let me show you the sound and the fury.
I purr. Oh, more than just show, I think. You gave me the sound and the hot, hot fury. Okay, more, more. I imagine him shaking his head as he paces about his flat, maybe goes to his window and gazes at the city, wherever he is in it.
Actually, I'm not much for pickup lines. I'd rather be direct. Would you like to have dinner with me this weekend?
Oh. I sit up, purse my lips, try to contain the hot air balloon of excitement rising in me. He's so old-fashioned, and I love it. I love that he's not playing the hey game and the sup game. He's not doing the I'll text her in 48 hours thing either. He's both smooth and uncomfortable at the same time. It's endearing.
Oh, is that bad? Is that a no?
He sounds genuinely worried, and I don't want that for a second. It's a big yes, actually.
A big yes,
he echoes, and I can hear the smile in his voice.
Then why don't you tell me what kind of cuisine you like, and I'll make a reservation for Friday night.
We spend the next 15 minutes talking about food, our favorites, our likes and dislikes, and it's so refreshing not to discuss work with this new man. It feels good to discuss life, the little things that make it taste good. As I hang up the phone, I can't help but think that maybe this is part of the reason London will be good for me. Because the city might hold painful memories, but it has this amazing new job, and now the potential for true romance, too. The next morning, an email pops up on my phone from Andrea in New Haven. You will have a good day at your new job. I just know it. How, you may ask? Because my grandson took his first step this morning. It's a good luck kind of day. I reply right away. I can't wait. I hope it'll be good. But I also miss New York desperately. Hope to see you soon. You, Central Park, the Met, the taco truck I love. I hit send, check at the front desk to make sure my luggage will be delivered to the flat, then head to the office, ready to tackle the day and determined to make my mark. It's a good luck kind of day after all. When I reach the reception on the sixth floor, a woman with a wide smile and bright red hair beams at me from behind the front desk.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Josephine Brennan. I'm starting today.
I know. I'll get Emily. She's excited to meet you.
I'm thrilled to be here. And you're, I ask as she pops up.
Claire Reynolds. I answer the phones, she says.
So good to meet you, Claire. She scurries down the hall and less than a minute later returns with the boss. Emily is elegant in gold-rimmed glasses, but trendy in a leopard print blouse.
You must be Josephine, she says, extending a hand.
Yes, but I also answer to Joe and Jojo. Whatever works for you, I say breezily. She smiles.
I already love your attitude.
With a laugh, I thank her. I try to be easygoing. Emily presses a hand to her heart.
That's a breath of fresh air.
She gestures toward the hall.
Let me introduce you to the team.
The office's aesthetic is both sleek and colorful, a mix of steel walls with rose gold and muted orange accents. The design is in sync with the approach of this house, strong but trendy. I hitch my purse higher on my shoulder.
I'm so thrilled to be here and to get to know everyone.
And I can't wait to get to know you,
Emily says as we walk. Her kind eyes latch on mine.
Miranda told me you have your eye on the VP post we have open.
I'm definitely working hard for that promotion. I think I can bring a lot to the table.
It's a plum position, and we want exactly the right person for it, so I held off on making any decision until you arrived. That way, we can get to know each other before I fill the role. I can't wait to hear all about your vision, she says, and I want to squee. I'm not a squeer, so I don't, but I'm doing a fist pump inside. My dream is so close. Emily seems to like me already. Heck, she's been waiting to fill the position until we met. That's humbling and amazing, and I won't disappoint her. I look forward to sharing my thoughts, and also just to diving into, well, anything, I say, as she whisks me through the office. Fantastic. Let me tell you a little more about how we like to operate here. We endeavor to make sure all members of the contemporary department at Highsmith work in tandem with others. Over the last week, I've been brainstorming the best pair-ups here at the house, and I'm going to put you on a handful of projects with one of our top art experts. He's been here for nearly 20 years, has curated loads of collections, and has the respect of all his clients. He sounds great, I say with a smile. He's brilliant. His knowledge and expertise are truly unparalleled. She drops her voice to a conspiratorial tone. He's a little salty, but that's why I thought you'd be a great pair. Balance. That's a smart strategy in this field. I like her style already. I'm not afraid of salty. I'm from New York, I say, with a bob of my shoulder. Salty is de rigueur there. Perfect. When Miranda told me about your energy and approach, I knew you'd be a brilliant addition, and I'm so glad you were willing to relocate straight away. She sails down the hallway, and yes, today is just yes. A few minutes in, and I'm already making a good impression. Surely the promotion will be mine. I can feel it. At an open door, Emily stops, turning to me with a smile. And this will be your new team partner. Josephine Brennan, meet Heath Graham. No. Denial slams into me like a bolt of electricity out of nowhere. Please, oh please, let this first name be a wild coincidence. But when I turn into the doorway, my Englishman is seated behind the desk, tapping on the keyboard, eyes on the screen. He looks up without taking off his glasses. His face goes blank for a beat, and I imagine his synapses struggling to process that, yes, he's seeing me standing in his office doorway. His lips part as the reality hits, and I'm pretty sure he mutters something not safe for work. Yeah. Fuck me, too.
Chapter 9. Heath. The first meeting between the hero and heroine of Pride and Prejudice might be the most disastrous first impression in literature, but at least Mr. Darcy knew Elizabeth Bennet's last name. Jay Gatsby, for all his many flaws, realized that Daisy Buchanan was off limits. But me, when I met Joe on Sunday night at Sticks and Stones, I avoided such practical things. Last night on the phone, too, I focused only on our chemistry, the fun we were having, the connection. Words and wordplay trumped worldly details. But even if at some point we touched on something as basic as, I don't know, identity, would it have occurred to me to ask, hey, wouldn't it be a coincidence if we happened to work in the same field? Or maybe at the same damn company? True, her name might have triggered a query as to whether she could be our new director of contemporary European art. That is, if I'd known of Josephine Brennan's hiring, but Emily circulated the news of the acquisition of Bancroft House only hours before we were due to welcome the import. Josephine Brennan will be starting tomorrow now that we've acquired Bancroft House. Big plans afoot. That was all her email said. Did I think twice about it? No. Because it seemed impossible that the incoming director could be the same as my Joe. But here she is, standing in my doorway, the lovely, captivating woman who I'm slated to have dinner with on Friday night is mere feet away, looking deliciously professional in a black dress with short sleeves and tiny white polka dots. It's a little arty, fitting for our field, but businesslike too. A perfect mix of classy and pretty, which describes Joe perfectly. And she's still utterly sexy to me. But she can't be. She's my co-worker, my new colleague. As I take off my glasses, Emily beams, gesturing to Joe like she's a prize.
Joe has a master's degree in art history. She worked at Christie's in New York, then the Met, and she's been curating the modern European art exhibits for Bancroft in New York for the last year, Emily says. And at the rate Bancroft has been building their client base and winning business away from the other houses, we just thought it better to buy the competition.
Joe laughs, but with a nervous edge.
I'm so glad Highsmith did.
She sounds upbeat, like the woman I met, but like a stranger too. It's like Joe is playing the role of an enthusiastic new employee. The new employee who's my partner. Oh, fuck. Is she gunning for the job opening too? She's a director, same as I am. She sounds ridiculously qualified too. And I bet she doesn't even care about the work remotely part. She probably wants to work with people, and I suspect that gives her an advantage. Plus, she's a firecracker. The mention of Bancroft House reminds me of a collection I was after several months ago, and the memory snaps into place. Was it your firm that won the Abernathy collection of 20th century impressionist art over Highsmith?
Yes, that was us.
She squares her shoulders proudly, and well, she should. It was indeed a coup. Ticked me off to no end, but impressed me nonetheless. You have quite a reputation, I say. Her brows arch as she meets my eye.
A reputation?
The question is a challenge, as if I insulted her, but that's not how I meant it at all. I realize I'm still seated and remember my manners, standing as I try to correct this mess. A reputation as...
Yes, Joe has a reputation as being one of the best.
Emily says crisply.
She's sharp, passionate, and experienced, with deep knowledge of the field.
That's what I was going to say, I add, my jaw tight as I silently curse everything about this. I offer my hand to Joe to shake, and when she takes it, my brain inconveniently calls up the vivid memory of her nails raking down my back. She did leave marks. I spotted them in the mirror yesterday morning when I was shaving. I wanted more marks, wanted to feel her clawing at me madly, feverishly. I admit I had hopes of that on Friday night. Dinner, a talk, a walk, a coming together. Those ideas I push into a mental cupboard, slamming it closed so I can focus on the women here in my office. Emily flashes a